from Vice Sports, it is our friend David Roth joining us. David, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rich. Hi.
Wonderful to talk with you as always, and I'm excited to hear, as we get closer and closer to March Madness, about your journey into the basketball hinterlands. You you spent some quality time in upstate New York.
I did. I went to Albany, which is every sports writer's dream, and it delivered. Everything you've heard is true.
I was there to broadcast football in the fall, and I was telling somebody this the other day. Albany is what it is, but there's a great coffee shop there that I love quite a bit. Professor Java's Coffee Emporium. I highly recommend it to anybody.
I wish that I had known that when I went up there. I found a nice place while we're plugging Albany coffee shops. I had two delightful cups of coffee at a place called Stacks downtown.
Yes, I've been there.
But yeah, oh, cool, yeah. I mean, but I was kind of, you know, guessing at a lot of stuff. I have a friend that moved up there, and another friend of mine, they brought their kids. So it was kind of, I was working at night, and then during the day, I would like hang out with them and their children at like near empty women's games, like first round women's games in the MAAC conference. I say it with two syllables so that people don't get it confused with the Mid-American Conference. This is the Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference, which is like Siena and Iona and all these other sort of Catholic schools from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
But there's something wonderful, though, and I hate to use the word pure because I'm not sure that any level of collegiate athletics is completely
right.
That, but there is something that's a bit more innocent at that level.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, that was part of why I wanted to go. I mean, I have always, I mean, I'm I like basketball, so I will watch pretty much whatever. Like, I mean, I watch Rutgers games by choice. Like, I have no leg to stand on in terms of judging what other people do. But I have always enjoyed these games because it's a super dedicated fan base. And these players are really very good. I mean, they're just not, you know, at that like national tier in the way that like players from Kentucky are. You know, there's usually a couple guys from Kentucky on that team, but most of them are the best players from the best AAU and prep programs in the country. And they're there for a year and then they go play for the Magic or whatever. Whereas like in this case, these teams they're recruiting locally or they're recruiting. They have, you know, one gimmick. Fairfield, for instance, has a ton of international players on their team. And it's to see that and to see, you know, that sort of, there's something more distinctive about it, more like sort of local or, I don't know. I mean, it seems a little bit more team-like and a little bit more communal than it is at the highest levels. Because it is. I mean, the schools are small and players are not bailing after 1 year to go play in the NBA because, like, you know, maybe one player from the conference will get to play in the NBA every 5 years. That's mostly the way it works.
I'm not going to lie. I'm a little jealous, too. It appeared that you bonded with Lucas, the Fairfield Stag.
I did get to spend some time with Lucas, which was nice. We didn't really get to talk much, sadly, but I did get the experience. I was in the media workroom at one point during the day games, just like charging my phone. And I got to hear the sound of Lucas the Fairfield Stag, which is a very goofy looking mascot, walking down a long empty hallway by himself, which is a really, like, I don't think I'll ever hear anything quite like it. It just sounded like somebody was like throwing pizza boxes. It was really strange, but there was a lot of cool stuff about being able to be up there, and I'm very happy with the fact that I got to do it. It's so easy for me to, I tend to, you know, whatever, fire a lot of shots from the couch and hanging out, you know, in a weird drafty arena for 3 days. It's not always fun, but it is definitely it's a lot closer to the actual fun part of sports than, you know, watching ESPN is.
Yeah, so at the other end of that spectrum, I still love March Madness, despite the efforts of ESPN to suck all the joy out of it. But how can we still enjoy big-time college basketball, knowing what a big-time business it is?
It's one of those things where if you'd asked me this about college football, I would have a whole big patter prepared for you. But the answer for me on this is just absolute abject moral cowardice. Just duck it. Forget it. That's all. It's the only thing I know that works. Like, and it's, you know, and I think in, you know, many ways it is, obviously it's exploitive and there's, you know, everything that's sort of gross about it is, you know, the same thing that's gross about college football. And yet somehow because of the fact that it's a sport that I like more and because of the fact that there's less physical trauma inherent in the whole thing, I just sort of let myself slide on it. I mean, like, I really do like watching it. And then there's always these moments where you do sort of get reminded of how much money is being made and how, you know, how it's going to any number of, you know, less deserving parties, but it's never going to the players. Like, the, as gross as that is, it's, I don't know. I mean, there's something about it that is, that's distinctive and that's unique. And I think it's every year I'm able to talk myself into that, redeeming all of the stuff about it that's gross. And then I kind of feel bad about it for a couple of days. And then by the time the next season starts, I'm excited again. And I already forgot any ethical qualms that I had. And I have to tell you, there is an ethical way to do it, but I have not figured it out.
Well, no. But and I don't know about you, but I love the early rounds, perhaps even more than the finals, because it's that sort of combination of the giant, well-funded powers and those teams like the ones that come out of the MAAC.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really where it's fun. I mean, it's cool. Like, last year we had this amazing, historically awesome final, and that's always nice. But by the time you get down to it, it's, you know, everybody's bracket's blown up. Like, sometimes it's been blown up for weeks, and you're left with like teams that you're mostly familiar with. And you know, the surprise element of it is, it's still there because it's college kids under pressure. Like, if you've been a college kid, like, I couldn't even get to 1 o'clock classes on time. Like, how these guys are able to do anything, you know, while in front of a national TV audience, I don't know. But you know, that it diminishes somewhat. I think the beginning of it, when it's so wall to wall, those first, you know, 2 days, especially, where it's just basically like, if you sleep in, like, you can just watch basketball for the entire time that you're awake, from like,
oh, yeah,
from noon until like 1:15 in the morning. I mean, obviously you can't sleep in because it's a work day and all that, but that overage of it. And then the same thing, I mean, conference tournament week works like this for me too. It is, you know, like, you watch some emotional final in the Horizon League, and it's like, one of those teams is going to wind up, you know, a 15 seed and get sacrificed to North Carolina or something. And that probably won't be that fun, but it's like, they're playing their hearts out for the chance to lose to North Carolina by 31 points. Like, that's, there's still something honest about it. And there's an emotional high that you can pick up with it, even if you know that it's not, you know, going to impact the broad sweep of sports history or whatever.
We're talking with David Roth of Vice Sports, and we love talking basketball with you, but we also love getting your views on the rest of the world. And I have to ask you about, because you've tweeted about him, is there anything more, I guess, oddly, wonderfully bizarre, and yet at the same time frightening, about the magic that is Dr. Ben Carson?
I was thinking that you'd ask me about Dr. Ben. The answer to your question is no, not that I have found. I mean, he is really on another level. And I had forgotten, because I assumed he was one of those guys that, like, sort of ran for president, but also didn't want to serve in any sort of office. I mean, I think it's just, he's very wealthy and very bored, and he likes being on TV or something. The idea that he's now in charge, you know, the biggest landlord in the United States, it's harrowing, and I don't like it, you know, personally. But at the same time, anything that puts more Ben Carson on my TV is like something that I'm pretty into, just because he's like on this kind of like psychedelic beat poet vibe that you just don't see public figures ever get on. The thing that I was thinking about was, he had his first address as the head of, you know, the Department of Housing and Urban Development somehow involved him going off on this monologue about like the power of your mind, and if your brain cell was an ocean, it would be bigger than all the oceans in the world. Think of it, you know, like the idea that there's somehow all, it's like the idea of him talking about that and then eventually steering it back towards like necessary repairs in public housing in Indianapolis or whatever. Like, it's a long way to go. And yet, like, he's, I mean, that's the thing that's so distinctive about him. There's no doubt there. Like, he just gets off on that, and he's like, this is good. What I'm doing is cool. I should keep doing it. And
but,
he just does it.
But the thing is, he's got to work hard to stand out in a crowd that includes Jeff Beauregard Sessions and Spicy and Kellyanne Conway and the strangest, perhaps, of all, Stephen Miller.
Yeah, I mean, creeps, all of them. And yet, he somehow, and I think he probably is, too. I mean, I think that if he were, you know, his politics don't seem terribly well articulated to me. Carson's don't. I mean, I think they're, the whole thing with him is he's all vibes, you know, that it's just kind of like, he makes people feel relaxed. It's like a yanni that has like really reactionary politics, but like the, you know, piano stuff as well. But yeah, like he definitely, at least he's not, you know, sort of combative in the way that all of these are, that like,
right.
There's this sort of way in which like the whole culture starts to feel like Trump at some point. It's exhausting, right? Everybody's always doubling down on stuff and getting in people's faces, and like, it all feels kind of rote. I mean, for Trump, that's all he knows. He's just a creature. He's id. I mean, he's pure instinct. But for somebody like Sean Spicer to have to go out there and constantly act like he's about to break a beer bottle over someone's head, I don't think he's really like that, you know, but that's like his job, is to sort of convey it. Whereas like Carson just doesn't seem to have that in him, man. He's just like constantly noodling.
So the bizarre reality that we all wake up to every day, has that had an impact on how you cover, how you view, and how you write about sports?
I mean, I think the answer to that is probably more than it should, or more than I would like. But yeah, I mean, of course, it's tough. I mean, I think I had this experience earlier this year. It was like shortly after the inauguration. My editors sent me, I think partially as a prank, to a Nets-Knicks game. And it was like just a low ebb for both franchises. The Knicks lost a bunch in a row. The Nets always have lost a bunch in a row. It was in Brooklyn. And the idea of it was, I think that, you know, I would, what is it like to go to the least important basketball game, you know, of the month? And so I went, and I had like, you know, I'm trying to be professional. I'd like pre-written some thoughts on it. And I had this idea that it was going to be like, you know, this basketball game played at the bottom of the ocean, like nobody there, nobody cares. Like, you know, like, and instead it was awesome. Everybody there was so dialed in to the emotion of it. And it was also the worst professional basketball game I have ever seen. Things were done on that basketball court that I had never, and hope that I never see done again. Like just carnage. But everybody was so happy to be there. And I think in some ways, maybe this is projecting, so happy to not be like staring at their phones to see what, you know, new dread had emerged in the world. But like, I mean, I think it makes the games more necessary, and it makes, I mean, just the horror of the moment. Not even, you know, horror is a heavy word, but I mean, just in terms of the uncertainty of everything is stressful. And, you know, and frightening in that way. And yet at the same time, like the idea of, I mean, I'm not a big stick to sports person in terms of how I think or write or talk about sports. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for that worldview. And yet at the same time, like the games are meaningful because of that escape. Like, it doesn't mean that they happen somehow in a time or place outside of politics or outside of current events. But they can give you a break from it. And I was so grateful for the Mets tournament and the opportunity to write about it for that reason, too. I mean, I was just like, I spent a weekend with my friends watching basketball and like being around people that really cared a lot. Like, it's not quite the same thing as a protest march, but it's the same sort of feeling of, you know, being somewhere outside of the usual sort of noise.
Absolutely. And that's why we love talking with you. David Roth of Vice Sports. Matt, it's always a treat. Thanks for being with us again. We'll do it before too long, I promise.
I hope so, man. Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. It's David Roth, Vice Sports.